Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey there, I'm Eddie Schumar with Executive Director Aaron Fairbanks, and you're listening to a special community session on heritageradionetwork.org. You can listen to this and other shows archived on heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Today's guest is Robert LaValva, Director of New Amsterdam Market. Thanks for being with us today, Robert.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was fortunate enough to hear you speak last week at NYU in my food systems planning course in the Master's in Food Studies program. And you have such an interesting and passionate story about how you went from being an architect and being involved in city planning to being the director of New Amsterdam Market. So if you could kind of really give the listeners sort of that backstory to get us started here.
Sure. Well, I actually never really did practice architecture. Right. But I was always drawn to cities and systems in cities, as well as biological and natural systems. These are the things that interested me when I was in college. And I ended up majoring in urban design studies because that was the one major I could find that in any way addressed some of these interests. And ended up getting a degree in architecture, but found myself not really drawn to the design world as I perceived it at that time, and found my way instead to work as a city planner for the city of New York, working in the Department of Sanitation. This was during the 90s. I started in 1993, and I specifically worked in the recycling division, and the recycling program was just getting implemented in those years, and I was working on organic waste composting programs, which was a very innovative thing at that time and really fascinated me. I sort of came to it by accident, but found myself very much at home in that work.
Right. And so talk about how you sort of transitioned from that into the food world. You know, what drew you to markets and building markets?
So it's a lot easier to answer this question now, many years down the road, because what I, in looking back, realize now is that because I was working as a city planner in New York City, which is an intensely urban place, and was drawn to the life of the city, and eventually found my way to the markets, the green markets. I was but not with really any real cognizance of what was happening there. But because of my work, working with organic waste and composting, I began to know people who were also talking about things like permaculture and organic agriculture and food systems, even though there maybe wasn't that word wasn't really being used that way at that time, but essentially what we're talking about now. And so without really realizing it, I was learning about that world as well. And because I always personally liked to cook, as I started to think about the food that I was buying to cook, I began to become curious about those food systems. And that is how, when I'd been working on the as a planner in the composting program for almost 10 years, had thought it was time to move on and do something new, and found myself drawn to working in food. And I wasn't exactly sure what that would be, but that was my intention. And so that was how I transitioned and found my way to Slow Food USA, mm-hmm. where Patrick Martins had opened the U.S. office of the International Slow Food Movement on Broadway and Howard Street,
right,
in Soho over there. And the office, I think, had been open maybe 6-8 months or so in that location. And so I was among the kind of first group of people working under Patrick, and it was a very dynamic place to be at that time, and very exciting, and to really be learning every day about everything that everyone now is talking about on this radio network and more and more throughout the city and everywhere. That was really the beginning of it, certainly in this country, and it was a great place to be at that moment in time.
Right. It's, you know, you're sort of like ahead of the curve this whole time here. So, you know, talk about the New Amsterdam Market. What is different about the New Amsterdam Market, say, to the Union Square Market or typical farmers market?
So the New Amsterdam Market emerge as an idea during my time at Slow Food, and I was trying to find my way of contributing to this idea, and thought for a while I would open a shop and sell locally produced foods and sustainably sourced ingredients. And in my search for a way to do that, came to think instead of myself owning a shop, but putting together a market of people who would do something similar. And how New Amsterdam Market is different than the Green Market is that it's specifically a market not for farmers, but for small food businesses who are sourcing and either using or reselling primarily regional ingredients.
So who's the market for your market? You know, who are the customers? Who are you looking to attract to New Amsterdam Market? And then we'll get into where the New Amsterdam Market, because I think that's really
right.
Sort of the crux of our conversation right. today.
Well, I think like all markets, certainly as we've established ourselves over the years, we've begun to grow a customer base of nearby residents who are seeing it as a local market for them to do their grocery shopping. And then beyond that, we've also cultivated an audience, I would say, of people, the most forward thinkers in the food movement, who are interested in all of this kind of developing economy of small businesses, and who are drawn from all over the city as well as beyond to get to meet the vendors of the market. I think that's been our two audiences.
Right. So the New Amsterdam Market right now is being held at the South Street Seaport.
Yes.
And where the old Fulton Street Fish Market is.
Yes.
Why there, and why is that space important to you?
Right.
And New York City in general.
So as I developed the concept of New Amsterdam Market, what was always extremely important to me from the very beginning of the project was that this had to be a public market. And in the way that I understood that, it really had to be in a public space, a building or a site owned by the city of New York, owned by the people of the city. That to me, in the same way that the Green Market is a public market because it takes place in Union Square or the other parks or streets throughout the city, this as an indoor market should take place in an indoor public space. So that was a very, very important aspect of the project. And around the time that I introduced the market as a one day event working under Slow Food USA, it was in October of 2005, literally 1 month before the Fulton Fish Market was moved out of its site of almost 200 years in Lower Manhattan to the Bronx, moved very much against its will to that site in the Bronx for a number of valid reasons, but yet against their will. And that happened in November of 2005. And so I began to wonder, after having had a one-day market event that seemed to indicate the potential of the project, where could a permanent site for it be found that met that requirement and be a public site? Looking at the Fulton Fish Market, realizing that that was a publicly owned, two public-owned market buildings, that, as I later discovered while learning everything I could about Fulton Fish Market, was actually marking the spot where public markets had been held in New York City since the city itself was born as New Amsterdam in as long ago as 1642, in that very location. So the fact that these two public buildings had remained in a very, very public market site that was surrounded by what really should be called a market district, that still remained, it seemed almost too obvious to me that I should do whatever I could to bring this new market into that very old market site, both for the purposes of finding a home for the market, but also for the purposes of highlighting the importance of this site, because the site was only being considered and still remains considered as a real estate development site.
Right. So, you know, you talked a little bit about the history, and, you know, despite New York City's abundance of fresh markets, we don't really have like a central market like a Borough Hall or a Léal like in Paris. Does that space, because it has such a historical context, is that why you're drawn to it? Why preserve that space?
Well, I'm drawn to preserving the space because it is such a rare and unique site. and the buildings, the actual market buildings, are themselves, there's an extraordinary story about their evolution that can be traced all the way to the origins of New York City. And here you have the last two ever that were, there were a series of these buildings built along the East River starting in 1675, culminating with the two that are still standing there in that one spot. And given that they are the only two that are left, for that reason alone, they're worth preserving. And even if they were not to be used as a market, but of course, how much better to then put a market inside of them.
Right.
And I just wonder too, you know, as we're moving into this kind of new age of kind of information and communication, you know, what do you think is the benefit of having a physical space over having, you know, a video of it or pictures of it or other types of documentation? I mean, at what point is it worth the kind of trouble to preserve a historic building? And, you know, I know there's kind of there's groups across the country who work at preserving spaces in cities all around the country. And I guess I just want to think for you, for in this context in particular, like, you know, why? Is there something about the building that's so kind of beautiful or amazing that, like, you know, knocking it down and building some new kind of modern thing, like, why not do that? Like, what are we getting from that physical experience that we can't get in another way?
Well, I think any physical experience is something that can only be gotten through that physical experience. There are actually some really interesting wire sculptures I recently saw at a gallery in Chelsea that by Edward Tufte, the graphic designer. And these little sculptures cast shadows. And he points out that the only way you could ever really see that is by seeing them there in person. You could not reproduce that same effect via photograph or video. And in that way, those two buildings, in their own irreplaceably unique way, are casting a shadow of four centuries of market activity on the East River that they hold within they serve as vessels of that memory. The traditions that were carried on in there can be traced to the very origins of the city. I think the experience that they have to offer is so unique and so uniquely of the city of New York that we should do what we can to preserve that, because we will continue to learn from it for generations to come.
So who, you know, who's stopping that from happening? Like, why isn't that the case?
Well, I would say it's New York itself as a city that is not necessarily stopping it from happening, but making it very challenging to make it happen. And that's because I think that the spirit, the soul of New York is as such a continuously dynamic and energetic place to continuously destroy and rebuild itself. And that is the very essence of New York. And you can, you know, when you consider that the very tip of Manhattan was once the equivalent of a 17th century Dutch city in brick, and that we no longer have a single remnant of that, you think what an incredibly crazy place this is that we wouldn't have preserved one brick of it. And yet that's what makes New York, New York. However, when the forces are opposing themselves, if you can also bring the force of preservation against that dynamic force of continual self-destruction, from time to time, they balance each other out. And in those cases where you succeed, you end up preserving a real landmark, if it can withstand that test.
And so, like, in our head, when we kind of, as a society, kind of try and categorize what we put value on, of course, there's, like, the immediate needs of, you know, shelter and food and, you know, somewhere in there comes the arts, comes the historical drive that we have as a society to preserve things. And what do you think, I mean, what is it about the market space that, like, what category does that fall into? Or does it fall across a multitude of categories for different people?
I think it certainly falls across a multitude of categories. But what compels me most about it is the fact that this is a public waterfront, which has been a public waterfront since the very origins, and even before the origins of the city. Native Americans used to gather in this exact same spot as well, because it was a natural crossroads. And to have had a place remain public for so long on the waterfront, which our waterfront in New York is rapidly being transformed now. We're seeing the effects of some of the rezoning efforts that were put in about, I guess, 8 years ago or so, and that now that there seems to be more real estate construction happening. We're starting to see huge developments of buildings all along the waterfront, certainly in Brooklyn. And I think I'm questioning what kind of waterfront is that creating. And so here you have a very last fragmentary piece of a 19th century waterfront, which is on a totally different scale and which says something totally different about our relationship to the water. Shouldn't we, this being the one and only piece that's left, I think we should really cherish that, because again, it offers something that nothing else can offer.
So, you know, we just recently had a city council meeting, mm-hmm. and a vote on it. So what's the city's sort of viewpoint on that? What's their counter to yours, and what are their vision for that space?
So this is a very long and detailed story. So without getting into those details, I think in the very essence of it, the city government, for very valid reasons of its own, has viewed this site as a real estate development site. In part because I think, having worked for the city and been part of its government, I think the role of government is to maintain and run things and not necessarily to innovate things. And so the city is about maybe a decade behind this emerging recognition of the role of cities in food systems. And so it doesn't yet necessarily see the value of this incredible and historic and strategically located market site, the role that can play in the emergence of new food systems in New York. Instead, it sees it as waterfront property that potentially could be valuable to a real estate development. And real estate development is always a good thing in New York. And so it hasn't, the understanding of its value beyond or even far greater than as a real estate development site has not yet sunken into the minds of the city government. And so they've proceeded along with the various steps necessary to turn it over to a private development site.
And so are there any plans within this private development for a market space? I think I read the other day they have a space sort of sanctioned off for 10,000 square feet for this market. Is that a compromise that you see as a compromise, or do you see that sort of as just placating to you and to the fans or your supporters of the New Amsterdam market?
Well, I think the only reason that provision was put in there is obviously because there's been such widespread support for what we've been proposing. But this provision itself is nothing at all along the lines of what we were seeking to achieve, because first and foremost, it does not in any way ensure the preservation of those two market buildings as market buildings and as public market spaces. Furthermore, it puts the development of what should be a public market with a public purpose in the hands of a real estate developer whose only mission, even stated mission, is to generate as much revenue as they can out of the site. And that market, therefore, is destined to never really happen, or if it does, to not last very long, or to be put in such a way that doesn't achieve any kind of public aim.
I think we are going to move to just a short break, and when we come back, I know we have a lot of stuff to talk about, but in particular, I'm curious about the impact on the producers who use and make use of the market. So hang tight. We're in the studio with New Amsterdam Market Director Robert LaValva. I'm your host, Aaron Fairbanks, and my co-host, Eddie Schumard. Hang tight. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Excellence by Tom Cruise on heritageradionetwork.org.
ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
All right, we're back. Thanks for tuning into the Heritage Radio Network. This is a community session. I'm your host, Aaron Fairbanks, my co-host, Eddie Schumard, and we are in the studio with New Amsterdam Market Director Robert LaValva, kind of talking about the emerging issues facing the New Amsterdam Market. And I want to talk into a little bit about, you know, who are the vendors at the market, and because you guys have a little bit of a history behind you now, maybe you can share with us some stories of people who've come into and out of the market and the impact or what the market has allowed for this kind of sector of small-scale food producers.
So again, the vendors that we seek and the ones that we always welcome are the people who are in one way or the other sourcing regional ingredients. So one example would be a company called Brooklyn Cured that's owned by Scott Breedy, who had an idea a couple of years ago that he wanted to start producing charcuterie using locally sourced meats, and came to the New Amsterdam Market and asked if he could have a stall there. And that was his first foray into starting his business. And we played a very important role, and the market like this can play a very important role in starting a business like that, because, for example, he's not someone who had, you know, huge amount of money to invest. He couldn't just open a storefront. Plus, he's a very careful kind of business person. He wants to test an idea before he proceeds with the next steps, which is a more organic kind of growth. The market allowed him a very affordable way to rent a stall and just have to make a once-a-week commitment that he could juggle with other work that he was doing and start producing the products he wanted to sell, and to launch his business with relatively little investment and risk and grow it in a way that he could become more and more sure with each step, such that he now has a couple of employees and has really developed wholesale accounts and so on and so forth. He's really grown enormously, and the market is what helped him do that.
And you guys do tons of like super fun events. I mean, the ice cream social, I think, is what jumps to the forefront of my mind. But what role do kind of the events play in the market dynamic, and how do they help to kind of create or continue keeping that as a lively space or introducing new people to the space?
So the events have played a very important role, because the site that we're interested in redeveloping as a market is in a way a very pioneering place. It's a somewhat remote corner of the city. You have to take a subway ride to get there, and then a long walk from the subway, and it's on the edge of a river. It doesn't have a huge residential population all around it. So for this market to really function and thrive economically, it's going to have to be somewhat of a destination. But to make a destination takes time. And certainly with the kinds of vendors and the kinds of food production that we are promoting, there aren't very many people who are really doing that yet. It's something that's emerging, but it takes time to grow. So one way to bring the site to life and give it that kind of energy that it needs, and for people to feel what it really could be, is to have these events that, first of all, thematically echo the kind of larger concerns that we have as a market, because we're always promoting some kind of seasonal harvest or some kind of emerging regional food product or sustainably harvested product. And so these are things we want people to learn about. And holding the events draws a great crowd to the market, gives people a glimpse of what a future permanent market would feel like and be like every day of the week, even.
I mean, so with these events, you've had, you know, pretty great turnouts for them, and that's been sort of like you're a community stakeholder, and that's been your claim. Do you feel that was sort of largely ignored by the city in terms of the planning process of that site?
You know, I would say that has been one frustration in this project, because it would be one thing to simply be promoting an idea and say, I've got this big idea, and produce or given spreadsheets and business plans, which are all very important. But it's still quite another to actually be doing something and physically and successfully doing it, and not just once or twice or three times, but over and over and over. Over the course of the past 5 years, we've staged a number of quite well attended and very well received, very strongly thematic, meaningful events. And yes, I would say that is one thing where I felt, one moment where I have felt, I wish that we're given more credence,
right?
Because it's something very real.
I kind of want to go back to the vendors a little bit, because, you know, when we talk about markets and using food and food, you know, local food producers as economic drivers, you know, in New York City and across the country, I think a lot of people are looking to start markets like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how important are those, like, meaningful, transparent relationships with those vendors in the success of building the New Amsterdam market, or for listeners, you know, interested in starting their own market in their own cities, how important are those relationships in the success of a market?
I mean, I think a market is only as good as its reputation. And if you're purporting to represent something, you need to be vigilant about really representing that. I would say the best, absolute best example of that that I'm aware of is the green market system in New York City. They have a very well managed and very well organized and very stringent system of controls and verification of what farmers are bringing, and they're very vigilant about it. And it's important to do that. You have to do that, because, as June Russell, who's in the green market, told me, you must trust but also verify. And
that's a Ronald Reagan quote.
Right. No, I know,
that I use often.
But well applied, applied, because that is a function of markets, actually, over the centuries. That is the reason why you have this public forum for selling food, because it's not just a place where people gather to sell food. There's someone watching those people selling food, and that's the role of a public market. We at New Amsterdam Market are still so small and young, and our resources are limited, and we don't have the ability to monitor our vendors in that way. So at the moment, it's largely based on trust and without the verification. But, you know, we're still very small, and we don't have a written set of rules yet that we wouldn't be able to enforce. But nonetheless, we are constantly in a dialogue with our vendors, and we are in that formative moment where we'll work towards that next level, which is very, very important, where you actually can say that as a market, you're ensuring that what people say they're selling is what they're selling.
Right.
Can you maybe tell us about, you know, without naming names, a time where you had to say no to somebody who wanted to be a part of the market?
Sure. Well, primarily, and this is, you don't need to really name any names, we've said no at least once a week to people who want to sell sweets and baked goods and cookies at the market. And that's just for a very simple reason that first of all, you run the risk of becoming just a place full of sweets. And all in all, there's not such a huge connection you can make with the local food system and that kind of food. So that's been an easy one. I think prepared food vendors, we try to not have too much prepared food at the market either, because we don't want it to be, I mean, we love all these innovative new kind of street fairs that have come on the scene, that they're really original and unique. But since we're trying to create a real market for ingredients, we're cautious with how many prepared food vendors we allow to be part of the New Amsterdam market. And there is a very, you really have to be able to talk about how you source your ingredients. And, you know, if someone says that they source them locally and you say, what does that mean? And they say, oh, well, I have a distributor in Queens. You know that maybe they're not exactly on that
path. Understanding the question.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, it's still such a small world of people who are doing this. So it's not really been, except for the cookies and the non-food items that we obviously screen out. Mostly it's a process of receiving or accepting the people who are doing something very committed and learn about us and come to us. So it's really more the opposite.
And so, you know, what are you guys are a market, you know, that's happening, and that's a big part of your identity, but you're also essentially this kind of advocacy and preservation organization. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if folks kind of want to get involved in your work or lend their resources to you, like what are some things that you're in need of right now, or what are some ways that people can kind of show that they support what you're striving towards?
I think right now we're in at a real crossroads with the market because of the recent political events, and that we have come to re-identify what our battle or what our next steps needs to be. It's a little hard for me at this very moment to identify where we need help, but I do think we will need a lot more help and support in these coming months and year. And I think the best way to get involved is simply please write us. Our email is easy. You can write info@newamsterdammarket.org or volunteer@newamsterdammarket.org. In one way, that is very easy to get in touch with us. Let us know if or join our mailing list, because over the next few months in particular, we'll send out appeals for help. So that would be the best way.
And just curious, you know, all like barriers and maybe all reality aside, if you had a magic wand, I mean, what would we be seeing at the New Amsterdam Market 5-10 years down the road?
I think you'd see something along the lines of what people are starting to call a food hub, very adapted to its site, of course, but where I feel that because of its location, it's not going to be a market where it's simply about retail sales every day, because it just couldn't be sustained in that way. I think there could be some element of some food production or processing happening in those buildings. I think that obviously there would be a weekly sort of weekend big markets where you have lots going on inside and out and outside. And more than anything, because of the waterfront location, I think this is going to be a place where, as new ideas emerge of transporting food over the water again, certainly this would be a place where we would welcome anything that's emerging in that field.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the difference between the market as a public space versus the market as a private space. You know, where, why is one better than the other, and what are the benefits of, say, a public space versus, you know, a mall?
You know, I think I personally happen to be someone who's always felt a certain quality of public space, just the very knowledge that you're in a building or in a site that is owned by you, owned by the city that you live in. To me, that just conveys something that a private building or space never can or never would. Doesn't mean that those places couldn't be incredible on their own and beautiful and compelling, but they're not public. And that to me is there is a quality to that. Beyond that, I think the South Street Seaport itself offers us a lesson. When the South Street Seaport shopping mall development that was developed as what was called a festival marketplace in the early 1980s by the Rouse Corporation, when that was built, it was considered a very innovative, developer-driven way of engaging people with cities again after they had all fled to the suburbs. And as part of that development at the South Street Seaport, the Rouse Company included a public market, quote-unquote. It was in a building that stands on the site of the very old original Fulton Market, and the building is called the Fulton Market Building. And the architecture is made to be someone reminiscent of the 19th century market hall of New York City. And on the ground floor, they had a market. I remember visiting it years and years ago. It was somewhat reminiscent of Reading Terminal Market in the way that it was set up. And it had a number of New York City purveyors of different types. I think something like Zabar's might have been there, or there was a fish market in there. And well, now that space is a gap. And it's been a gap for, I think, at least 17 years. It didn't last as a public market very long because obviously the owner did not get the profit out of it that they were looking for. And if it made no more sense for them to keep it there, they shut it down and replaced it with something that brought in more revenue. Ideally, if it's a market is in a public space, it might ebb and flow and it might have periods of being less profitable and less productive. But because it's in a public space, it's a lot harder for it to be shut down.
And well, there's a little bit more flexibility in a public right. space, it seems. It can be, right. you know, the city has a little bit more option to deal with it. If you know, the market's not doing so well, it become an event space. And there's a lot, it seems like there's more flexibility when it's a public space.
Or even as a market. I mean, one great example we have is Essex Street Retail Market, which managed to survive through a long period of decline. And because it was in a publicly owned building, it had this kind of staying power. Now it's thriving. If this had been completely privately owned, it would have been shut down maybe in the 1950s or 60s or 70s, and never have survived through that slow period and come back to life.
Right. I'm just thinking like the public private space and wondering and feeling like a little afraid that like looking back at the Gap as like the thing that I hearken back to when I'm in my like late 60s and 70s. It's like, oh, remember the Gap and how amazing it was, and preserving that as a thing. It just seems highly unlikely.
Right. Well, I probably would agree, although, you know, nostalgia can do a lot of things, but, you know, the Gap can be the Gap and wherever it needs to be built, but let's not put one inside of an authentic 19th or 20th century market building that is a public space. Why give that over to that kind of development?
Sure, so making more kind of decisive choices, mm-hmm. and protecting space. I think essentially right, coming right. back to where we started,
right.
the like need for preservation and protection and celebration, mm-hmm. I think too. I think maybe something we haven't touched on quite as much as we should have is just how fun it is to go to the New Amsterdam Market. I mean, I definitely love to bring folks down there and check out the different stalls and connect with the vendors. It's a totally different and super dynamic afternoon of eating and shopping and kind of celebrating the best that the city has to offer. So kudos to that.
Oh, thank you. And that, of course, is a reflection of course, our vendors and all the great things that they're doing. And it's a real honor to be able to gather them together under the roof of one market.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Robert.
Well, thank you for having me.
You have been listening to a community session on the Heritage Radio Network. We have been talking with Robert LaValva, director of the New Amsterdam Market. And this, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, can be found via our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you believe in what we do, we hope you click that donate tab and become a member today. You can also find us for free on Stitcher Smart Radio and iTunes. Stay tuned in. We'll keep coming back with more great radio here on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.